The history of Alaska is intertwined with the military and geostrategy. Its presence is a powerful, often overwhelming historic force, but it's a history we're always having to rewrite. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today we have a couple of rewriters with us. You'll probably want to join in. Our phone number is statewide 1-800-478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage of 550-8422. Statewide, Alaska's hidden military history is the subject today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and Alaska's communities and in operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. The Rasmussen Foundation Sabbatical Program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth, and organizations often become stronger as a result. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
So I'm headed home yesterday, and I go by the federal building, and there's a sign on there. It says James Fitzgerald Courthouse. And I think, you know, I used to sit right in that building and listen to Judge Fitzgerald hear cases. And then I realized, but I can't remember what the case was. I think it might have been the St. Matthew Island case. And I said, I've been a journalist in this town for a long time, but not as long as the people that are across from me. And so, you know, the connection between journalism and history is maybe changes when you get older and you've lived through a lot of it. And you start realizing that you lived through it. And you start looking back to the part that happened before you got here and got involved. But we've got, I think we'll start with Lael Morgan. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska, Lael.
Thank you, Steve. It's good to be here.
I think the last time we had you on, we were talking about the history of prostitution in Alaska.
Yeah, I cover a lot of spectrums.
Yeah, and the and you had an interest in the gold rush. When I think about your time at the Tundra Times, and that takes me back to one of these geopolitical things, which was Project Chariot. Which is, oddly was not really a secret. And I suppose we'll be talking about things that were once secret or thought needed to be kept secret and stuff like that. We'll talk about that quite a bit on this show. But Project Chariot was actually right out in the open. The very president of the University of Alaska was there promoting this idea of blowing up a hydrogen bomb to create a port someplace around Kivalina so they could get those ores out, have a nice deep water port, and they'd be able to test their nuclear bomb that way. And the Tundra Times kind of led the way in giving a platform for people who thought this might be a bit outrageous.
Well, the Chukchi Sea is too shallow for big ships to come into Point Hope, even if they had a deep water harbor. And the secret part of that deal was that Edward Teller wanted to test the effects of fallout on humans. And so under the guise of doing a great deed and building a harbor with atomic energy, that's how he flacked the deal.
Yeah.
But the secret part really was pretty disgusting because the bomb was 17 times bigger than the one on Hiroshima.
Yeah. And it was, but it was, it's so interesting that the powers of the bee were all for it.
Yeah.
They were all for what a great idea. Good economic development. We'll have a port.
Well, Mumbai's places are all about jobs, you know.
It's an interesting part of our history. And, of course, the very president of the university, William Wood, who did that and also was responsible for, as we've talked about on this show, pretty much getting two people fired at the university. Because they looked at the environmental effects of this, we have a building named after him. And so it is. So we got a courthouse named after a judge that I used to listen to hear cases, and I can't remember what case it was. And we've got the the Atwood Building, which is actually the Hunt Building, named after Robert Atwood, a big part of the history of having a newspaper, a boosterish sort of newspaper in Anchorage. And the building that Mr. Atwood built is named after Art Snowden, who was the administrator of the court system. And nobody remembers that it was the Hunt brothers that actually built the building that's built after Robert Atwood. And so it goes, changing names and putting names on things. And so we come to General Simon Bolivar Buckner, and we got things named after him. And we have General Buckner in charge of Alaska during World War II and not happy about the fact that the Corps of Engineers is going to send black soldiers to build the Alaska segment of the Alcan Highway. That's where you came in. You wrote this up, Lael, back in what, 1992, something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They had the 50th anniversary of the Alaska Highway, and I had gotten an assignment with National Geographic to do a story on the highway, and they envisioned that I would do a little House on the Prairie story about all the people driving up to Alaska to start new lives.
They didn't know you very well, did they?
Well, they didn't know the economy very well, because when I started covering the story, I found a lot of people driving down the highway to get the hell out of Alaska because they couldn't find jobs because our boom had gone bust. And so I was looking for another hook. And in the White Horse Library, which seemed to have the only books in the world on the building of the Alcan, I found about 10 books commemorating the development of that one road between Alaska and the United States proper. And there were no pictures of black people except just one guy who was actually shaking hands with a white guy when they connected the north part and the south part. And I kind of wondered, since all the troops who built the highway in Alaska were black, why they had been left out. And Buckner was part of the answer.
Yeah. So he objected, and it's sort of a famous... Do you have the quote with you, Pete
Porco? I do have it right in front of me.
Go right ahead, then. This is amazing.
Buckner...
He's objecting. He's basically objecting to the head of the Corps of Engineers about these battalions.
Well, the blacks had never done any major things in modern warfare. They'd always been stevedores and confined to the dock because nobody thought they were strong enough or bright enough to do war zones.
Yeah, partly maybe like lacking in education.
Right, yeah. And a lot of them hadn't had much chance for that. Buckner, unfortunately, was the son of the guy who surrendered to Grant.
That's the Civil War.
The Civil War, yeah. And he wasn't very happy with the idea that the Corps of Engineers couldn't find anybody to send to Alaska to build the highway, except black troops who'd never been tested anyway, except stevedoring. And he argued, as did the governor of Alaska, Ernest Greening, but here is his direct quote: "Certainly the Army has a responsibility in not further complicating the population characteristics of the territory by leaving a trail of new racial mixtures."
Whoa.
So the military, the Corps of Engineers, cut a deal with Buckner that the black troops would not go near any settlements, that they wouldn't go to any recognized military bases, that they kind of would stay out in the woods and build the highway.
Yeah, it's amazing. Just an amazing piece of history. And so little of it written that you get the chance to write up in 1992. But did they ever print it in National Geographic?
No.
Oh.
They fired my boss just before the story was due. And then when they took a look at the story, they fired me because they didn't want a whole story focused on black people who built the highway and what about Little House on the Prairie. So I had a non-compete clause in my contract, which meant I couldn't sell that story to another magazine or write a book on it.
What a clause.
It just said that I couldn't compete if they didn't accept the story. I couldn't sell it to another print publication.
Yeah.
So I went to the Humanities Forum and got a $10,000 grant to do a museum show of the blacks and building the highway and telling the story with captions. And that show was a good one because we found beautiful photographs. And it went all over the Pacific Northwest. It went to a veterans reunion we held in Florida. And then it went to the Pentagon. So we didn't compete with National Geographic exactly, but we did kind of make the presence of black troops known. And the fact that they did such a darn good job that after they built the Alaska Highway, Buckner actually requested that the 93rd Regiment, which was all black, be assigned to the Aleutians to help liberate it from the Japanese.
So he changed its tune.
He did indeed.
So he was, as generals tend to be, he was a practical man.
Yes, and those guys did one heck of a good job. What they did was impressive.
So they build the Alaska segment of the highway, and then they're past Tok at the border waiting for the other guys.
Right. The white group was supposed to come up from the south and meet them at the border. And when nobody appeared, they just kept right on marching and built into Canada, where they were even less welcome than they had been by Buckner.
Now, these were engineers. So essentially they were building what was often a gravel, a corduroy road even.
Yeah, because
and,
that's
and bridges, lots of bridges.
Yes.
Huh. And so they were figuring all this out. I mean, this is engineer work we're talking about.
They did a darn good job, and the road remains the only land link we can drive to the South 48 today.
Hmm. I want to turn now to my other guest, Peter Porco, who, did you start with the Anchorage Daily News here in Alaska?
Yeah, I did.
And you came up when?
1981, 35 years ago.
35
yeah.
years.
Yeah.
And you moved on from that to, I'd say, poetry and playwriting.
Yeah.
And other things. But you certainly, weren't you also involved with a museum exhibition about the Aleutians?
No, I just gave a talk there about Hammett on Adak.
And you've had a chance now to get out there.
Yes.
To the Aleutians.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons I wanted to invite you here, because both you and Lael continue to keep your researches alive. And I think that is so interesting and so indicative of what to me is the theme of this program, that we have to continue to write our history. I mean, you look at the Alaska Highway that we mm-hmm. kind of thought we knew the story, but we didn't know a whole lot about the story. And now there's a move afoot to put up a monument, and I want to get back to that because I think it'll be maybe we probably should. And then here we got things named after General Buckner, but we don't really have a monument for the Corps of Engineers that built this incredible achievement. And so, turning to the Aleutians, I guess we had black. There were black soldiers involved with that as well, weren't they?
Yes, they were. And there was a fellow named Chris Rowe. He's a former military person who he got his thesis, his degree in anthropology at UAA, and his thesis was on, it had something to do with black troops in the Aleutians. And he discovered a map. He found a map in his research, and through interpretation of the map, he realized that on Umnak, The military had segregated black troops. That the I think it was the 93rd Battalion. They came from building the highway, sent to UMNAC, and they were sequestered. And you know, I mean, the military was officially segregated until 1948. But and
so
Lael's,
that was Harry Truman.
Harry Truman did it. Yeah, and mm-hmm. and Lael has written about this how. Actually, Lael and Hendricks, I forget Hendricks' first name, but the big book is Alaska at War, the one that came out in 93 or 95. But anyway, they've written about how actually Alaska relaxed the segregation. I mean, there was some kind of integration. I mean, you see photographs of black and white troops attending events like dances, attending softball games out on the Aleutians. So there was some integration going on. And then you had people like Joe Louis visiting Alaska in the Aleutians in 1945 and giving boxing demonstrations. And so there was this mix. And of course, we know that on Adak Hammett, Dashiell Hammett, running the newspaper out there, he hired two black GIs, and one of them became famous, Don Miller. So while officially the troops were segregated, there was, I think, some kind of relaxation going on. And, you know, I mean, there was a manpower shortage. I mean, so they had to use these troops. And the black people in World War II, they were really agitating to be, first of all, not only accepted. You know, they had this thing called the double V. This was a phrase used in black newspapers of the time. Some of the black troops put it on their bodies. The double V was the V for victory over the Axis powers, but then it was also the V for victory over their treatment in America, their discrimination. So anyway.
Absolutely. Absolutely spellbinding. Just so fascinating. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. I think we're particularly interested in hearing from people who heard stories maybe or have experienced themselves firsthand with some of these things, but especially the stories that relatives have told and things like that. It would be great to hear, and looking forward to your calls from all over the place. We haven't even touched on the Territorial Guard, and the stories actually just go on and on, because I think when I was meditating about it this morning, that it's partly because this geostrategy and these military questions are such large forces, and Alaska has so few people that they are very overwhelming forces, and we get kind of tossed around, and it's always when you're tossed around by something, it's hard to write the story. It's hard to get some distance to get the perspective.
You know, Steve, we've been talking about black troops in Alaska, but there was an effect on Alaska natives as well. At least I know for sure in Anchorage, because Buckner, I think he gave an order that Alaska natives could not go into certain institutions, that they had to be separate from the white population, and that gave a sort of a green light to bars and other institutions, restaurants, to say no natives allowed. So up and down Fourth Avenue during the war, you had institutions that were actively keeping out Alaska natives, Eskimos, Indians, and so on. Yeah.
When I got here, Pete, in 1959, there were signs still that said no dogs, no Coast Guard, no natives.
You remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I remember Jeff Silverman? Jeff.
Yes.
Looking for one of those signs. Looking for an image of one of those signs to get it in his documentary about discrimination. I mean, finding it difficult. But you saw him.
It wasn't difficult in 1965 when I worked at the Empire in Juneau. They had one in two of the bars downtown.
Well. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. Let's go to Mark, joins the program from Bethel. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Mark.
Hey, good morning, Steve. Great to hear you again. Lael, your son is Lael Well, and Pete, sure appreciate you being on there. An area of Alaska history that I'm kind of interested in, and I hope other people are, is the history of military and government intelligence in the state. It runs all the way from Shemya, the reconnaissance aircraft base out there on the radars, the story of stories of Lend-Lease up in Fairbanks. I recall reading, my goodness gracious, 25 years ago or something, kind of a true murder mystery that happened up there between the Russians and the Americans. But one particular story that, and I can't remember the name of the author. The book is called My Way Was North. The guy who wrote it was one of the first U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service agents in the state. And he started back in the 30s, I guess. And there's a chapter in his book where he talks about going on a visit to the Aleutians in the late 1930s. And he said the Aleutians were, you know, a lot of the islands were not exactly crawling, but there were an awful lot of Japanese nationals out there. And he said it was really strange because there appeared to be navigational marks being put up, and they were taking weather observations, and they said, oh, we're here. There's going to be a Tokyo to San Francisco friendship flight, and we're just doing some, you know, advanced work for that.
Wow.
And when he got back to Anchorage, he corresponded with the FBI in Anchorage and said, hey, you know, you guys really ought to take a look at this. And I don't think we need to go on with the rest of the story. And I wonder if Lyle or Petey, the one of you, are aware of that. And maybe you've read the book's really good book.
Well, there's another really good book that the University of Alaska just put out about a photographer who lived in Unalakleet, who is Japanese, who has documented 30 years of Unalakleet. And he is beaten to death by the troops right after the Pearl Harbor bombing. And the question is, was he one of those spies or not? But there's no question but what the U.S. government knew they were there. And they also apparently knew that Hawaii was also going to be bombed. They knew that days in advance.
Right. And this is several years before the attack on the Aleutians. Apparently the Japanese were out there really, because as people that are familiar with it may recall, they were able to evacuate. It wasn't a Kiska. They just vaporized. The Japanese and their fleet just vaporized from Kiska. And when we got there, like, where did they go?
Yeah.
It's a pretty.
There were still casualties, but yeah. There were still casualties, but
I just wanted to drop that line out there, but I think there is an awful lot of story to be told about intelligence in Alaska. There's also
Mark, I remember we did. I remember doing a talk of Alaska about 2 years ago after an article came out, L.A. Times, I think, and it was about the recruitment by the CIA of pilots and so forth. As spies.
It was the Air Force. It was the Air Force. They were recruiting people to, yeah. They were recruiting Alaskans, kind of woodsmen, to be search and rescue personnel for aircraft coming back from World War III, and also stay behind guys to watch the Russian invasion of Alaska.
Yeah.
Well, both Bob Henning and Ed Fortea worked for what was the equivalent of the CIA during World War II. Henning as the cover of a newsman, and he also, I think, was buying furs or trading down in the Yupik territory.
Yeah.
Who was that?
Bob Henning, who owned Alaska Magazine.
Okay. Yeah, so there's a lot of quiet history that may or may not ever shake out. But I'm going to listen to the rest of the show. Great job. It's wonderful to hear all you folks there. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you, Mark. And also a shout out for Mary down in Ketchikan. To you, Lale. Says, I've been her fan since 1973. That's a long time. That's right. It is indeed a long time. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call on Anchorage of 550-8422. Pete Porco, it sounds like you might know a little bit about this Japanese before the war.
What I've read, I think that's pretty well accepted now, that the mm-hmm. Japanese were coming out to these islands, Attu, Kiska, and others, and they were mapping. You know, a fishing boat would stay a week in a bay. I mean, it was a little bit suspicious. Some people were suspicious about it. And you know, of course, once they attacked, they moved right in on Kiska and Datu. And so, yeah, I think it's pretty well accepted that they had been spying ahead of time and checking out those islands.
But you should also note that their map making wasn't all that accurate, as we discovered during the bombing of Dutch Harbor. They made some pretty bad mistakes on some of those maps, which is one reason we won the war. I think they may have spent more time on the fishing than the mapping back in the 30s.
But there was also these little submarines that they had.
Two-man submarines.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I toured the battlefield at Attu with five Japanese people who had all been stationed there at one point. And they went directly to a spot and dug up the bodies of five of their people. And if everybody had escaped the Battle of Attu or been killed, every Japanese, then I said to them, and they all spoke perfect English all day, I said, how did you know where to find the bodies? And suddenly they didn't speak any English at all. So I think some of them probably escaped in one of those mini subs.
Wow. It's so interesting. I mean, the living part of this history is like actually evaporating, and it, you're like day by day right now.
Well, but there's a big interest in it, Steve. Just as we're speaking right now, there's a tour of the World War II sites, the military sites out on the Aleutians right now, run by a company out of California. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, Valor Tours. Yeah, they've got it. Yeah.
Having looked at you, you've been there. I mean, they could stomp on that. I mean,
there's a lot to see out there. Yeah, there's still a lot.
There's also a piece of history that everybody has ignored. During the Battle of Attu, our side used mustard gas.
Huh.
We tried to mustard gas the Japanese. The wind shifted, and we killed some of our own. But mustard gas had been outlawed by the Geneva Convention. And I don't know of other places during World War II where they used mustard gas, but they sure as heck did in the Aleutians.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Do you suppose somebody screwed up?
They didn't understand the winds. If you walk that battlefield.
Well, yeah, they obviously screwed up on that, but I mean, this is prohibited materials here. And they're using it. I mean, that's a command decision somewhere.
Right, indeed. Bob Henning, when I was working for Alaska Northwest, gave me a month in the National Archives. And at that point, all the records for the Aleutians were there. And that's where I found that documented.
Wow.
And the only place that's ever been printed is in Alaska at War.
Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255. If you've got more to add or got questions for our panel that's, living history, really, 1-800-478-8255. Statewide and toll-free, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. With a rich curriculum from art to advanced engineering, over 10,000 alumni strong, 90% of their students go on to a four-year college or other post-secondary education. Explore your talents and develop your dreams at Mount Edgecombe High School. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
Oh, we're talking about hidden military history, forgotten military history. Sometimes they didn't even bother to hide it in Alaska, and how we're constantly having to revise the story as we learn more. And meanwhile, you go back to, say, the World War II era, And the fact of the matter is that we're like losing the eyewitnesses. I mean, they're up in their 90s, and there's hardly any of them left. You were, Pete, telling me about a writer that you had not known about who was, you know, you think about Dashiell Hammett was out in the Aleutians campaign, and you think about Gore Vidal, who was in the Navy, as I understand.
No, he was. It was work for the Army, but it was an Army freight transport, troop transport vessels. Plying the Aleutians. Yeah,
right. So you know, pretty famous American writers, and then you came across another one.
I did. His name is Elliot Asimov, and he too worked with Hammett, and he's best known for writing the book. 8 Men Out, about the 1919 Black Sox baseball scandal.
Now we're down to sports talk.
Now we're down to sports. And Asimov was a minor leaguer himself until he got injured, and then he became a writer. And he became a writer because he worked for Hammett. Hammett gave him his interest. And anyway, yes, he was fascinating. He became a lefty and was a front man for blacklisted screenwriters and authors, and then was blacklisted himself. And you know why he was blacklisted? Because he was outside Yankee Stadium with a petition saying that the Yankees, in the early 50s, the Yankees should integrate.
In the 50s?
Yeah, really terrible stuff. Terrible.
So this would have been about Jackie Robinson era, before or after?
Well, it was after Jackie Robinson, but the Yankees hadn't been integrated yet. A lot of ball teams were not integrated.
Yankees are still a little buttoned down, aren't they?
Sure. Well, pinstripes. What do you say?
It's talk. We're finally doing some laughing, which is good because I know these two people really well, and we all laugh together quite a bit. 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK. Talk of Alaska. Jim joins the program from Wasilla. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jim.
Yeah, good morning. I lived and worked in Cold Bay back in the early 70s and met a native guide out there, Mike Utek, and he told me in 1927 that he guided the government. He didn't specify what agency, but he guided them into Cold Bay because he used to live and hunt in that area. And then he says they came back in 1935 and built a weather station in Cold Bay. And he said, why would they build a weather station there if they didn't know they would need it for a military installation anticipating World War II with Japan?
Yes. And I guess, wasn't that one of the Lend-Lease points where they went across?
What he said was that the Russians brought in, or the way he put it, rotten, worm-eaten lumber for our military supplies.
Huh.
And they picked them up. They picked up ships and supplies at Cold Bay and then took them on over to Russia. And then they used that lumber to bury military equipment in Cold Bay after the war, and they would stack lumber on top of the military equipment and then drive more stuff on top of it. Used to be filled up ravines full of that stuff. Well, there was a couple of GIs that knew where that stuff was buried, and they went back there in 1959 with a cargo plane and started digging up guns and ammo, loading that stuff up, and they stopped them in Anchorage. They were headed to Cuba, 1959, with all that stuff out of Cold Bay for Castro.
That's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, well, you know, when you talk to the right person, you know, you get a lot of history.
Whoa.
I'm sure Mike's not around anymore, but he lived there at Cold Bay. He had his own actually lived in an old Weatherbill house there, but he was a guide to people out on bear hunting trips. That was his specialty.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot of history. You know, we take it for granted that when you see somebody who's, you know, weathered and wrinkled, that they're just old. Yeah, but they're old and they know something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was an interesting place there in Cold Bay.
It was. It remains interesting.
Yeah, and he said the Japanese were never able to find it. He said that's why they picked that spot, because the weather was so bad, it was socked in. And it was. I've seen some amazing weather out there when I was there.
Wow. Yeah, well, of course, it's on the other side of the Alaska Peninsula from King Cove and, you know, like what's accessible from the Pacific. You have to come up through Unimak.
But yeah, they even lost a squadron of fighter planes in World War II there because of, you know, the weather conditions.
Yeah.
So, yeah, anyway.
Jim, thanks so much for that call. That was absolutely fantastic. And it puts me in mind of when I first got here as a journalist, and Pete Caron, I was working at KTNX, a commercial radio station, and Pete Caron was the news director, and he said, "Will you track down Norman Vaughn?" And Norman Vaughn was never here. He's staying at the Military Y, which is now the Willow Hall in downtown Anchorage. And that's where he would stay when he was here. But he wasn't here that much because he's traveling a lot. And the reason that he wanted me to keep calling, and we had this list of calls that we had to make in the news department, and we would call Colonel Vaughn once a week or so, try and reach him, was because he had heard that Colonel Vaughn was trying to find some airplanes that were underneath the ice of a glacier up in Greenland, American warplanes, and damned if he didn't one day find them. We called him up. Colonel Vaughn answers the phone. We said, "Did you find the planes?" He said, "Yeah, we did." We had a scoop just like that. Yeah, Jim brought that memory back, talking about the guys trying to get to Cuba with the stuff they looted from Cold Bay underneath some boards they knew about. I mean, what a great opportunity this show is to get living history. Let's try Donna and Toke and see what happens. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Donna.
Oh, good morning. Morning. I do love the history of the show.
Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm. My family is originally from Unalakleet, and my question is about the Alaska Territorial Guard. My grandfather was in the 2nd Territorial Guard, but my great-grandfather, Shafter, was in the 1st Territorial Guard. Now, there's very little written on the Eskimo history in the Territorial Guard, but I knew they played a vital role. And my mom used to tell me about the days when they had the blackouts along the coast. Nobody could even light a candle.
Yeah.
But trying to find the information on it has been difficult. I have found group pictures of the Territorial Guard, and there's been mention of both my grandfather, Richard Ayagat, and my great-grandfather, Shafter, in books. But I can't find individual photos. And I'm just wondering if the people out there, you know, who document all this history can connect me. And also, there was a lot of history with my family and the White Alice site in Unalakleet. Mm-hmm. Trying to get information is so difficult.
I think it's going to remain difficult, but Leo probably has some suggestions for you.
Yeah, okay. Mike Duck Marsden, who was statewide commander of the Territorial Guard, wrote a book about it, which has photos. I know because mm-hmm. he got Howard Rock at the Tundra Times to sell them. So one of my jobs was to sell the book. And that's probably the best account there is.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I've seen that book and their names are in it, but the photographs aren't.
Well, I suspect if you wanted to look that Marston has a collection at one of the archives in the state. And I can't imagine he didn't have photos of those troops.
Yeah, generally speaking, I think that documentation is the neglected part of archiving.
Yes.
And, you know, so it just takes a lot of persistence and really helpful librarians, if you can, to help you actually dig for these materials. But, you know, I think persistence can pay off, though, Donna.
You're talking about the White Alice sites, too, I believe, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And I was pleased to see that the Anchorage Museum has quite a few photos of them. And I think if you just plug White Alice into the state database for museums and archives, you'll probably be quite surprised.
Yes, I've gone to that site before. I used to work at a White Alice site, so I'm familiar with them. But I'm just having trouble finding individual history. And, of course, you cannot access a manifest from those White Alice sites. But the missing history that I'm looking for is family-specific. I know a lot of families go through this because they know their grandfathers were in the Territorial Guard. But the photos you see are a generic, you know, group photo. And I was looking for individual ones. And I'd like to do some more documentation on that because it is lost. I mean, who else has the interviews with those that survived, you know, during the times of the Territorial Guard?
Well, try using social media. Try using Facebook. Mm-hmm. When I started a book on Ray Wise-Mala, the Eskimo movie star, I stopped early in the game because I couldn't find enough. I left the project for 20 years. They finally invented the internet. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I put his name in and found family members and people who'd collected private pictures so fast I could hardly believe it. But you've got to tap in. There's a lot of Alaska Native people who are on Facebook who have great histories to tell, and it's the new archives for sure.
Yeah, it's a very good source, and Ilayla is right about that. But I would also go to the Consortium Library at UAA, the Archives and Special Collections, because those materials are donated from families, from individuals, and you might find something there from somebody whose grandfather or whatever was in the Territorial Guard, and also the State Library in Juneau. Of course, then you've got to travel to Juneau to look at it. But anyway, those libraries, I would also start there. But you've got a number of sources to go to. I agree. There's not been a whole lot written about that.
I think we're just beginning, Donna, and I really encourage you to pursue those.
I would like, just so I can update you, I have tried an internet search on the last name Ayagak. I mean, I challenge you guys to try it. Richard Ayagak, I mean, we don't even exist in ancestry, much less anywhere else. You know, it's very hard.
You know, we lost...
That tells me nobody documented his name.
We lost a great source of material. We don't even know everything that was in it when they closed the National Archives 2 years ago here in Anchorage.
Yes.
They moved all that stuff to Seattle.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. I know it's difficult to find this information, and I have tried the internet. I just hope more Eskimo families who can help document this, particularly from Unalakleet. Unalakleet had a huge role in the history, and yet I'm a descendant of Unalakleet, and I can't access it.
Well, don't just say, I tried the internet. Try it again and try it again. All you need is one relative, and you'd be amazed.
Yeah.
If you do an archive search, I did one for Good Time Girls, and I'd spent almost a month in the archives in Whitehorse. Just before I finished the book, I made one more pass, and there were about 20 feet of papers that hadn't been there 6 months earlier, which changed the whole course of my book. So don't just say, I tried that. Go back.
Yes, thank you. And I won't give up, because I know the information will someday be available.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Donna.
Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it. I think the listeners really appreciate hearing your desperation on that. Tim Ellis chimed in from up in Fairbanks and saying, hey, you shouldn't leave out that the pipeline to Haines. he says, I suspect we still have a cleanup issue there. And that was Corps of Engineers too, right, Leo?
I do believe it was, and it was quite an event in its time. I remember following it along, driving certain parts of the road nearby. It was one of the seven wonders of our world.
Yeah, and then it got completely forgotten when it came time to clean it up.
Well, one thing with the mysteries up here, Steve, you've got to remember the old Russian expression. Heaven is high and the Tsar is far away. The U.S. government and the military early on figured that out for themselves.
Yeah.
So a lot of things happened here that nobody much wanted to talk about, and they didn't work very hard to cover them up because there were so few of us up here.
And so if you have a guy that you know is kind of a left-leaning, potential subversive, like Dashiell Hammett, you station him out in the Aleutians. You got guys with what they would call sexual perversions at the time. You station him out in the Aleutians, and you don't even talk about it. And that happened, right?
It did happen. One of them told me that the Army sent to ADAC three kinds of people: troublemakers, homosexuals, and PAFs, premature anti-fascists. That's okay. Which is what they call people who, for example, fought in Spain, fought on the side of the Republicans.
Premature
anti-fascist, PAFs.
Wow.
And of which a well-known one was Robert Kolodny, and he's the one who was listed as the co-author of a booklet that came out in 1944 called The Battle of the Aleutians. Hammett was the major author, but a guy by the name of Robert Kolodny was a very interesting person, and He was fought in Spain. He got shot through the head and given up for dead. But he managed to come to when somebody was trying to steal his boots and in Spain. But anyway, then he was then sent to Camp Chenango as Hammett was. And Camp Chenango was a place where they put not only prisoners of war, but they put black troops, they put white troublemakers and people like the lefties. And then eventually Hammett and Kolodny both came to ADAC and they worked on the paper there. And Kolodny became, he became one of the very last people to be investigated by HUAC, House Un-American Activities Committee, one of the very last people, and he was cleared of allegations that, as a professor, he was a communist subversive.
Do we have a complete archive of the Stars and Stripes as it was put out there in the Aleutians, or just partial?
The Stars and Stripes, you mean the military paper? I don't know. I don't know.
Well, that's what Hammett
no,
was.
No. The ADACian.
Oh, ah, okay.
The ADACian.
Do we have all those?
Actually, they do exist. In fact,
And they actually had to typeset and everything for that, right?
They ran it off on a mimeograph, and then eventually it was a lithograph.
Uh-huh.
But the original, they did 6,000 copies off of a mimeograph machine. And the guy doing it was a black guy named Alva Morris. He was the guy who was doing that.
I'm loving this.
Yeah. He ran it off. But there are copies available. The Yale Library just a couple of years ago got. Okay, so Bill Glacken was worked with Hammett. His son Brendan Glacken, a lawyer in San Francisco, inherited this box of papers. I saw the whole thing, and they're very fragile because I mean they were run off on mimeograph but now they're in Yale. They're at Yale. So
Pete, we need to get you a whole crew to assist in the research.
Yeah, there's too much. There's too much.
Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
It's Talk of Alaska, and we're going to Carl in Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Carl.
Well, good morning, and good morning, Lael. It's good to hear your voice on the radio. I just wanted to follow up with the caller that was asking about finding out on Muktuk Marston. I did Google his name, Marvin R. Marston, and there's quite a list of publications that he was involved with, and quite a few citations. The book was called Men of the Tundra, Alaska Eskimos at War. Came out in the 70s, and I remember he had an autograph party here in Anchorage years and years ago. Since he passed away in 1980, it was quite a few years ago.
Yeah.
But it's a good book, and it does have photographs in it. I don't remember how many. I have a copy somewhere, but I'm not sure where it is.
Yeah, as I recall, she's seen that, but she's looking for particular photographs, so he's going to have to dig more.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, it's a good place to start, though.
Just go
to Google and put his name in, and there's the list of references. The other thing I wanted to mention was I did take Valor Tours out to the Aleutians 3 years ago on their first trip, and it was really an amazing experience to go to both Attu and Kiska It was on Kiska that we saw one of those mini submarines. It's up on the beach, and it's kind of rusted out and not in very good shape anymore, but it sure gives you an idea of how tiny it was. Apparently, two people could get into it, but I'm not sure. They must have been awfully small. They wouldn't have gotten in if I were one of the two.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just wanted to pass that on. Valor Tours is amazing. They go to a lot of military sites all around the world, and they got their, you know, they got an interest in coming up to Alaska. Even though they're based in California, they did a good job, and they're running two tours this summer back-to-back out there.
Mm. Wow.
Doesn't have room for many people. I think they can only take 10 on each one, but it's an amazing trip. If somebody wants to see another part of Alaska, that's certainly the one to take a look at.
Mm.
Anyway, that's all I had, but thanks for bringing this up. There's a lot of interesting history in the Aleutians, and not too many people know much about any of it.
Yeah. Thank you, Carl. We'll go now to Bobby in Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bobby.
Hi. Yeah, I was very fortunate in 1991. I was a merchant marine, and we were delivering a fuel tank to Attu. And we spent 3 days, I was working on tug and barge, and we spent 3 days in Massacre Bay, of which there were tons of remnants of the war all over the island scattered. You weren't supposed to wander off into these areas, but who was looking? And I had 3 days to explore the island, which I did with tiptoed around the island.
You managed not to step on any mustard gas canisters.
Well, that was one of my fears as well. But some of the things, I did take a lot of pictures, and some of the interesting things I had seen was the Quonset hut that was had about 16 prison cells on in it, and the Quonset hut being curved as it is, the actual cells were only 4 feet wide and 6 feet deep. And they were dirt floors, and I assumed that the Japanese had built these and had imprisoned the Atutans, the natives that were there. If you were over 6 feet tall, and you could see scribbling on the inside of the walls. I mean, it looked dreadful, quite frankly. But one of the other interesting things was was one of the old partially collapsed nightclub bar wooden structure that I'm sure was there built after the Americans had taken it over. But they're on the walls that some collapsed and some were still standing. Some of the military soldiers had pounded nails into the wall and used sailor's twine and wrote out their names. And I took pictures of all that. And I always thought it would be interesting if I could find those people and show them those memories of those of their names, where they had written their names with sailor signs on the wall in the bar.
Don't lose those pictures.
Yeah. And then one of the other pictures I took was of a huge safe that had been blown up. Whether it was blown up by the Japanese or Americans, I don't know. But I did quite a bit of exploring, and a lot of the buildings had collapsed. But there was one of the buildings I was able to crawl underneath of the floorboard. And underneath, there was about 2 to 3 feet gap. And I crawled underneath it, and underneath was all these military paperwork.
Huh.
But trying to retrieve them and back out of underneath this floorboard, because I was, you know, scared of spiders and whatever. But I was unable to. Plus, I knew it was against. You weren't supposed to take anything off the island. But,
was this Japanese paperwork or American paperwork?
It was American paperwork. But I briefly, because it was dark underneath the floorboard, I could make out a few. Like military order supplies.
Mm-hmm.
So forth, but there was lots of it, and I wish if I could ever return, I'd love to have gotten all those you know, obviously nobody knew it was there because it was, you know, under a collapsed building under the floorboard. And
Great story, Bobby.
It was a very interesting trip, I'll tell you. I know that the that there were only 25 Atutans that survived when the Japs occupied it. There was when we took it away from the Japs, there was only 25 Atutans that survived the Japanese occupation. They enslaved them, my understanding was. I always thought maybe I was the first Aleut to have returned there since World War II.
you could very well have been.
Yeah, but I'm glad to hear about that valley tour, because I'd sure like to get back on that island and get some. I found a lot of old-time Coke bottles and just various little trinkets. One of the more interesting things, I was walking along the beach where there was I found a rib cage skeleton. It turned out it wasn't, it was a seal rib cage. It was sort of frightening, though. I thought it was maybe a soldier or something.
It would have scared me. Yeah, we're just about out of time here, Bobby. This is absolutely fascinating. I'm thinking I might want to pass on your phone number if it's okay with you. Hello, Bobby? Bobby?
Yeah?
Can we do that? Pass on your phone number to Pete and Leo?
I'd love some of you pass on my phone number.
All right, wonderful. We will do that. And I want to thank you very much. We're just about out of time. We have some absolutely great calls. We could obviously go on for hours about this. Leo Morgan, where are you going next?
I'm going to stay home and be a good girl for a while.
Peter Porco, well, you getting back to the Aleutians again?
Yeah, I'm going to go out to ADAC one more time and do some reporting out there. I'm interested in contemporary ADAC.
Okay, and you the two plays that you wrote.
Yeah.
One was about Hammett.
Yeah, Wind Blown and Dripping, and I'm revising that one, and then I wrote The Lady is a Trucker, which is really about Anchorage in the war, during the war years.
And
that's about the Rusty Dow.
And you managed to squeeze in the
quote from
Simon Bolivar
Buckner. Yeah.
We never did get to the issue of whether we should be naming things after these people.
Well, you know, Buckner is really a fascinating character. I mean, the guy was an outright racist. I mean, he was from Kentucky. His father was a general in the Confederate Army. But Buckner did amazing things for Alaska. He built it up.
It's a mixed history. I want to thank everybody for the calls. Are fantastic. Lael, thank you very much. And thanks to the crew producing the show. I am Steve Hyman.
Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
ExxonMobil Alaska, working with more than 100 Alaska communities and thousands of Alaskans. Today, ExxonMobil is producing natural gas condensate from the Point Thompson facilities.
And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The Resource Basket is a training and technical assistance center helping rural communities support healthy, resilient, and culturally connected youth. Tribes and youth-serving organizations can request support, explore resources, and find opportunities at resourcebasket.org or call the team directly at 1-800-478-7227, extension 7396. This message sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.